welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And back again, sitting on the couch with us, is our good friend, Mike. Michael Bay expert.
Hello.
Yes. I was thinking, like, yeah, you're a Michael Bay and, like, epic action kind of guy now, with Spartacus and Armageddon previously, so...
To discuss all the finer points of Michael Bay movies.
Yep.
What are the finer points, Mike?
Explosions! Swirling cameras! And bombastic music.
Hans Zimmer at his best. Holy crap, this movie is fantastic. Who wants to do the plot synopsis?
I don't.
Look at Tom and he's just... No.
I'm sick of doing plot synopsises. Plot synopsis?
Oh yeah, we should say as well, we gathered a bit of a group together to watch this movie because that's the way this film needs to be seen. So Cole and Lee and Mike's girlfriend Suze are all kind of floating around in the room as well.
Look at that audio wave peak right there.
Obviously everybody's snoring too far away from the microphone.
Yeah. But I guess, Mike, do you want to take the plot synopsis on this one?
Okay, yeah, I'll give it a go. So, revolves around a war hero...
disgruntled war hero,
yeah,
Ed Harris.
Ed Harris, or Hummels as a character, taking hostage 88 prisoners... 88 or 81?
81, I think.
81 prisoners on the island of Alcatraz with the threat of detonating VX warheads onto the Bay of San Francisco. And it's up to our... good friends, Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery, to stop this madman.
I agree. I feel like I know them after watching this movie. Are they? Yeah. Well said. Like, and it is, would you guys agree that it is a no-holds-barred adrenaline thrill ride?
Yes.
I would agree.
Had shivers up my spine, like, every 15 minutes.
Okay, like, this is one of those films that falls in the same category as Armageddon. Where it is a giant question of why the fuck is this in the Criterion Collection? Like, alongside, you know, Ingmar Bergman and Fellini and Kurosawa, like, the greats of cinema. Why is The Rock included in the collection?
Well, it's definitely a far more complete experience. It's not retarded.
Are you saying compared to Armageddon?
Compared to Armageddon.
Yeah. I thought you were saying, like, compared to other films in the collection.
No.
Yeah.
I'd argue that.
It's not like the... Like, for example, all of the character motivations make sense.
Yes.
There's no narrative...
There's no space dementia.
Yeah, there's... I mean, it's kind of silly, and you can laugh at it, and you can laugh with it, but it doesn't... It manages to not go overboard enough to make you go, like, this is fucking retarded.
Yeah, and... I think you're right on with something there, like, where it doesn't take itself too seriously as well, where
the
characters are having, like, jokes and fun in the film and, like, kind of encouraging the audience to do the same, so...
We got Harvey, he's got his treat ball.
I was trying to let him roll on through and...
Weird noises, so that might occur.
Yeah.
Throughout the podcast.
I think we talked about this when we did Armageddon, whereas, like, the Criterion Collection has to include all aspects of cinema. And this, in my opinion, is the pinnacle of 90s action films.
But you did say that... Didn't you say when we were doing Armageddon that represented the, you know, the Michael Bay era of action?
That is a different start. That's a different beast, I think. Armageddon represents the... more family-friendly blockbuster.
Big, the tentpole.
Okay.
Things like Independence Day, like, you know, big family blockbuster films, whereas this is a hard R action movie that is meant for grown men who are kids at heart. Like, let's be honest, this is for men children.
This is
like,
something you should take, you know, some 10-year-olds to the movies.
Yeah.
But there's not much difference between the two of them. I mean, they're both Michael Bay films.
I disagree with that. Like, are you talking in terms of the construction of the film, or, like, the...
I'm talking about the general tone and feel of the films.
Yeah.
One just happens to be M, and one happens to be R. Like the
I think Mike is dead on, like, I think you were saying earlier, like, it has a decent story with, like, a good protagonist and thing. Like, sorry, antagonist, like...
We're talking about The Rock now, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, yeah.
It is heads and shoulders above Armageddon. And every other Michael Bay film.
Fucking oath.
Yes.
It's the best Michael Bay film.
Yes.
I'm just trying to differentiate where we stand from the Michael Bay Armageddon, where we might stand from the Michael Bay The Rock,
yeah.
And why those films are in the collection.
Because they... I think, like I was saying, like, they represent the two different aspects. There is the family-friendly, like, Hollywood blockbuster versus the action-adventure adult film, which is, like, a continuation of things like, you know, Die Hard and, like, Last Boy Scout. Like, that whole late 80s era.
The 80s, early 90s action movies. Like
Commando,
Terminator 2. The big, you know, the big Hollywood action star... almost invulnerable to anything from bullets to explosions to whatever. But it's the pinnacle of that. It's the culmination of all that. I would rate The Rock as one of the best action movies ever.
Side by side with Con Air and Face Off for that like late 90s period.
Oh, that burst of...
You cinephiles, if you're looking for a triple bill of high art.
Good Lord.
No, but the film is unabashedly stupid as well, and it revels in that, and that's part of its enjoyment, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is... Like, the chase sequence that happens early on in the film, like, that is...
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I would say that chase sequence is up there with, like, the bullet chase sequences.
You are really high right now, if you're saying
that's,
that.
That's
some hyperbole right there.
Whoa, calm down, man.
But... name other quality chase sequences.
Okay, Bullet, Death Proof, Vanishing Point, Blues Brothers.
The original Gone in 60 Seconds.
Yep. The Jerry Bruckheimer.
The Rock is not in
not the
any top 10.
One.
Yeah.
If you are asked like what do you remember from The Rock, you're not like, oh, that car chase scene.
But it is a high point.
It's a high point, but it's not the takeaway memory.
You need to watch some Vanishing Point, or you need to watch, like, just.
Yeah. well, for us casual moviegoers, I would say that The Rock would be up there.
everyone's just like, fucking, it's the best movie. It's not, no, fucking, fuck you.
Well, okay, I think that like that's something like for people of our age. The Rock, I think, is a touchstone, like, for men in their, like, you know, late 20s, early 30s, like, every one of us fucking loves The Rock.
Because we were young, we watched it,
Is it time and place, you think, that makes it hold up? And
no, it still holds up. I think it's hold up, you know, if I was, when we watched it, we were 12 when it came out. 10, okay. So we were 10 when it came out, we all watched it, and we all loved it.
Yeah.
I think if you showed it to a 10-year-old now, they'd still love it. Because it is for the man child, and there's a man child in children,
yeah,
and there's a man child in men, so it can kind of like cover the two bases. So
yeah.
you watch it when you're really young, and it's like exciting because it's, you know, violent, and like it's, you don't really realize that it's just a silly, unbelievable, ridiculous action film. Then when you're older, you can go back to the nostalgia and go like, this is so fucking stupid and unrealistic.
And it takes you back to that place.
Yeah,
that
I love
pure,
it.
That adrenaline.
Sure.
You're kind of shaking your head there.
Oh, no, just about the unrealistic. I mean, we have to get into a physics debate.
Yeah, no, I don't
movie.
Think that that's something we can bring up.
But I just mean that it's not... Like, the old Michael Bay films, the old... I'll just say that the old Michael Bay films.
This is the problem. Like, you're saying the old Michael Bay films.
Okay,
this
all Michael
is
Bay
second
films.
Film. This is his second movie.
I'll say all Michael Bay films.
Okay.
They're kind of. Like, I mean, let's disregard Transformers and stuff because they're just totally crazy.
Yeah.
But the older stuff, The Rock and, like, Bad Boys, they're supposed to be set in reality. But they have, like, these kind of quirks and oddities about them that kind of set them apart from reality slightly, right? They're kind of fantastical.
But that's every action film, though.
Yeah.
No, I know, but he's setting the bar for the that next breed of action film.
Yeah, okay, I'll agree with that.
But that's been going on since when
action cinema.
Since action movies.
But say like take Commando. Yeah. It's pretty realistic. In terms of
I'm doing air quotes.
Commando realistic. Wait, what?
No, but it's not. It's like, how do I explain? It's kind of when you watch it, it doesn't. It gives you
there's nothing
a
other
kind of realism
about it,
that's
yeah.
not entirely fantastical and like. There's explosions. People are shooting cars and they explode and stuff. But that's kind of, and that is kind of crazy. But the early Michael Bay's films, they've gone beyond that, where it's, you know, a tram will explode and fly into the air,
yeah.
you know, like,
and
8 meters, 10 meters in the air.
As opposed to a Commando where he shoots a missile into a mansion that explodes.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm going to have to
agree
with
that.
And I think what Michael Bay is doing, like, use the tram as the example. Like,
okay.
At the end of the car chase, when the tram explodes and shoots
yeah,
20 feet in the air.
Gets lifted up.
What he's doing with that is, like, he knows that's ridiculous and it makes no sense. But it's spectacle. And that's...
Yes.
That, and
yes.
His audience... Like, if you're going to see The Rock, like, you are going to see this shit happen.
Yeah.
And he's delivering that for the audience and doing it fucking well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think if you're going in to see an action movie expecting realism, then you are in the wrong.
Yeah, that's,
it's like going to see a Star Wars movie expecting a science lesson. That ain't
going
to happen.
But that's what I'm saying. I'm not going into it expecting realism. I'm going into it expecting something that's supposed to be grounded in realism but takes it to the fantastical extreme.
Grounded in realism, but you know, it doesn't have to be 100% realistic. There's
no,
a basis for that. And then you add on the
why
hyperbole.
I agree.
Fuck you, Tom, you're wrong.
I agree. I'm not arguing that it's real. I'm saying that it's not real. Like, it's crazy.
Wait, so Ed Harris isn't dead?
Oh, fucking hell.
We need to rein it back in a little bit.
Yeah, calm down, guys.
You brought up that discussion.
I'm saying that it's grounded in reality. It exists in San Francisco, but it's you know, be San Francisco, but it's doing weird shit.
It's not set in Metropolis.
Yeah,
or Gotham.
But it's set in a real world
place and time.
But what does that have to do with anything? I'm trying to say
that the Michael Bay action films,
yeah.
although set in reality, have. Taken things to the... I mean, that,
it's a hyper-reality.
Roswell, it happened in this universe.
Yeah.
No, they're saying
that... By the way, that is one of the secrets that Sean Connery
yeah,
is imprisoned to reveal.
But that exists in everyday life. That's part of the lexicon. Like, people...
No.
I'm not arguing that Roswell existed. I'm arguing that there is a Roswell conspiracy that exists in public discourse.
Theory,
yeah,
it's
no,
some same with like how no. people with the JFK assassination, with you bring up into new points conspiracy of 9/11, all
yeah.
that kind of it, this is all stuff that exists in the lexicon of the public. So of course it's going to play on that
yeah.
because it's a simple problem.
The,
I'm not going to talk about. Yeah.
I know. The film isn't unrealistic in terms of its narrative. It's just unrealistic in terms of its action, which is fine.
But that's, as we said, that's all action.
Exactly.
I've got to explain myself more then, because I'm talking about the presentation of a Michael Bay film.
Yeah,
it's a reality.
It's a hyper-reality.
It's a
hyper-reality.
Exactly.
What you're talking about.
That's the perfect way to describe it. I'm trying to say that Michael Bay is presenting a hyper-reality.
Yes.
Existing in a real world, but taking it to these ridiculous kind of ends.
Okay,
but you'd make that argument for any action.
Yeah,
I'm
wondering.
It's
good. Do you think that The Rock is a better example of that overblown hyper reality that you expect from action films than other films of that era?
Such as,
I mean, the ones that I'm gonna say are stupid and hyper. Bizarre, like Con Air or Face Off or.
I'm sensing a theme here.
Nick Cage. I know, I'm going about Nick Cage here, but like.
It can go two ways though. Like, you can take it as, is it good because
okay,
it's so.
Crimson Tide as well is another action film
yeah.
that is.
Would you'd say, you, I mean, you could. That's more of a. you could say almost
thriller
type of.
Yeah.
The basis of what you need for an action movie, you need a protagonist.
Yep.
Who everyone can rally behind. You need almost an outlandish villain or plot. Big bombastic score. Explosions.
Yep.
Or effects to
eye candy. Yeah.
And great one-liners. And I think this covers this ticks all the boxes of an action movie.
Not just that, but
quintessential action movie.
We're given two protagonists in this film, both Sean Connery and Nicolas Cage, who, on top of being like super fun and entertaining to watch in this film, actually have decent characters as well.
Hmm.
The character of John Mason is very... It's an interesting character. It's an interesting twist that you don't often see in the action film. The old man kind of planted in, and then he actually has the good, interesting past, and then you couple that with the inexperience of Nick Cage's Stanley Goodspeed character, like the nerdy, nebbish kind of guy, you know, seeing action for the first time.
Well, I suppose that's what sets it apart, in a way, to a few of the other action movies, like your Arnie movies, your Sylvester Stallone movies, your Jean-Claude Van Damme's, is that they're all big guys,
you know
bulging muscles in the tank tops,
like
whereas goods where
yeah Mary Sue's.
Nicolas Cage is a tall, slender man, balding, a bit weird.
This is right after his Oscar win as well for Leaving Las Vegas. Like, prior to this, Nicolas Cage was a weird character actor doing shit like Peggy Sue Got Married, Raising Arizona,
Leaving Las Vegas. Is this the first instance
of
Cage being the action hero?
Yes, this is what started it all. And then after this led to Con Air, Face Off, fucking...
Like an institution, like Hollywood institution for a while.
He became an action star after this film. Before this, he was a weird character actor, and you can see that in his performance. He fucking kills it in this film.
Mm.
He absolutely owns every single scene he's in.
I think like the idea that you have like an underdog, first of all, and then an odd couple.
Yes.
The two of them being an odd couple works really well.
And then you can kind of combat that against a sympathetic antagonist.
Yeah.
Ed Harris
and
is... Yeah.
I think that's what also sets it apart with the action movies is that you get behind Ed Harris's cause. It's like, oh, actually, this is a noble thing that he's doing.
You're not getting
almost villainish type of the Hans Gruber or...
The guy from Commandos is used to fuck guys like you in
prison. Or the Predator. The Predator. Like, it's okay, this guy's actually, he's got a proper cause.
We might not agree with him, but we understand his plight.
Yes.
I feel the way about Predator.
You understand the Predator's plight?
Well, not his plight, but I understand his motivations.
Yeah. Oh, it makes sense.
But that's also a great action movie, where
the Predator is a fucking sweet villain, because, he's just a fucking wolf.
But that's also,
he's a hunter, man.
Exactly.
Action films
are... respected, at least.
Yeah. It's like, if we can hunt lions, why can't he hunt fucking humans?
Plus, he's not human, so you can't lay the same rules on him, but,
That's a whole other thing.
Whoa.
Okay.
Is Predator in the collection?
No, I wish.
Should be.
There needs to be more John McTiernan in the collection. Okay, that raises an interesting point. Action films, do you guys agree, fall in the same category as like horror films, where they're only as good as their villain? Do you think that holds up?
Well,
yes.
Okay. Well, I'll go back to Commander. All right, the villain's I don't think you.
Dan Hedaya.
Like
the guy in the guy in the
The Aussie guy in the fishnet top.
Mad Max guy.
He's the head henchman. He's not the villain.
Yeah.
But he's your odd job. He's not.
Okay.
I don't think it's fair to say that an action film is only as good as its film.
No.
Because there are so many, like, you laid them all out before, like what a good action film needs. You need to have a great villain along with all of these elements.
Yeah.
If one of those elements is slightly off, you can tell.
Yeah.
I do think that Michael Bay films are slightly off. In their reality sense.
But, I don't see that as necessarily a fault, especially with this film.
But it depends on how you're presenting it. Like, if it works within the universe,
yeah,
it needs to be consistent within the universe.
Yeah.
In this film, it's consistent, makes sense, and all of the shit that doesn't make sense in the real world, you can go like, yeah, but it's fine, because it works, makes sense in this film. If you get onto shit like, if you watch Con Air and you watch Nick Cage getting like beat the fuck up the whole film, and then all of a sudden to save the day he has to hang off a truck and his elbow's just been fucked up and his arms all, you know, broken and shit, but he can still manage to hold on to stuff. Like, come on, man.
Not to mention the fact that they're driving down the Vegas Strip and then all of a sudden they make a right turn and they're at, like, a foundry factory that makes sparks and crushes rocks.
Hey,
by that argument, I would like to ask Mike. He looked it up while we're watching it, but I would like to ask why a film set at Alcatraz suddenly had the Mines of Moria.
The mineshaft, yeah. That was a
bit.
It was a cool sequence. Now
it was the minecart level from Donkey Kong Country.
I thought it was a bit, like, not that fascinating.
It's a little chase.
It was a set piece. We had had our previous set piece of the shower death, where all the shower scene where all the U.S. Marines die, and we sadly lose Michael Biehn, one of the greatest American action heroes. And then we have our nice, calm, quiet scene after the storm of Cage and Connery getting to know each other, the odd couple moments. But that starts to lull the audience after a while in a big Michael Bay bombastic action film. We need another ridiculous set piece, and that's exactly what that was.
That's fine, but every other set piece in this was pretty great for where it was set. And it worked with something great. All of those sets were great. You had coming in under the... You got under the sewers. I can believe that there are sewers underneath Alcatraz.
Yeah.
I can believe that. I can believe that there's a shower room and an observatory and a lighthouse. I believe that Alcatraz has these things. I don't believe it has Gringotts Bank hidden underneath it in these mines.
Okay.
My problem with the reality of this... Yeah. Hang on a sec. My problem with the reality of this is that it breaks immersion.
Yeah.
And this is why. An action film is fun because it takes reality to the extreme, just to the limit of what's actually really possible.
Mm.
Beyond that, you're looking at superhero films or supernatural films. They become sci-fi or something. There's extra to reality. That you go, I can accept that because there is magic in this universe or there's superheroes in this universe. But this is set in reality. This is San Francisco.
It's Macho Man. It's Macho Man doing macho things.
When people like Michael Bay... His films, I think, are problems because he takes it to that line, but he doesn't pull back. He continues over it, and he breaks reality. It's not possible for those things to happen, and therefore, your action heroes become Mary Sues, because what they're doing, there's no threat, there's nothing real about it, it's just ridiculous cartoon violence, because it doesn't. Sometimes it's real, and sometimes it goes too far beyond it, and you can't trust it.
Yeah.
That's why I think there's a problem with the reality issue in action films. You need to pull it back before it gets ridiculous.
But would you say that The Rock, I would say, is measured in that regard, which makes it one of the better ones.
You can't argue that
it has its flaws.
Yeah.
In those moments, it's like, come on now.
But
those
compared,
moments, yes.
Compared to other action films of this time, this is probably the most measured.
Watching it the whole way through, there are so many little moments, like all action films, where you go, okay, in reality, this would happen, or in reality, that would happen, but whatever. I'm watching The Rock. I'm willing to accept that. But what happened when I was watching this, and they reached the Mines of Moria, is I went,
I reckon that's
just like a different set piece. Like, they hired a different set for the day, and it makes no sense. And all of a sudden, I'm like, what... Exactly. How far do you really expect me to follow you here, Michael? Like, there's a lot I'm willing to accept, and I've accepted a lot so far.
You talked about the suspension of disbelief in watching action movies. So then, why don't I just turn around in Harry Potter and say,
magic isn't real?
I said that you can accept it in those films because you know that magic exists in this universe. In Star Wars, you know the Force exists. In superhero films, you know that there are superheroes. In X-Men,
like
there are mutants. You don't know what it is, but the film sets up that it's a different reality.
Yeah.
This sets up that it's San Francisco.
But an action movie is a greater... You're talking about... These are almost sub-genres you're talking about. The superhero movie is in the same bracket as an action movie. An action movie encompasses... The umbrella encompasses a lot.
Yeah.
And an action movie... You could classify the action movie encompasses your fantasies, your superheroes, all that.
Yeah.
So it's an offshoot of it.
It's a subgenre.
Yeah. Right.
But Michael Bay.
That leads to the question of then, is Michael Bay a genre in and of himself?
I would
attribute things like Commando to be the same kind of subgenre of action
as The Rock.
I mean many of the Schwarzenegger films would be the same kind of thing. The Last Boy Scout, same kind of thing.
Yeah,
I would say that they're all. Michael Bay is not his own genre, but he is.
He took that genre, right?
Because he was kind of. He's been there for a while through as that genre, that subgenre was developing. We don't really have a fucking name for this. Hyper reality action, let's say that.
Yeah.
Right?
That works for this.
I don't know if there's actually a name for it. But,
okay.
But he's part of that subgenre, and he's contributed to it, and he's built it up to be, and he's gone beyond that now to doing Transformers. And
that's my question.
Ninja Turtles,
like obviously a big tenet in film is like, what good directors want to do is take a genre and improve upon it, or like improve upon the art form and kind of build upon it. And do you think like? I'm not talking about like modern day Michael Bay. I want to talk specifically about The Rock. Do you think that he is taking what he's trying to do with this film is take the classic kind of action films and push it further and
do it better?
Yeah,
subjective way that might be.
And has he kind of succeeded in doing so?
This is one of the best of that genre, I would say, because it is measured. You need to know that you need to have a villain that you can get behind.
Yep.
That makes sense, even though you hate him and you think he's wrong, you can still understand the plot. You need to have interesting protagonists that are just beyond the, we need to bash heads with the antagonist.
Yeah.
And I would say that the protagonists are pretty basic. Like you have a guy that happens to be an underdog, but he really just, the bottom line is he wants to just save his girlfriend. And then you have Sean Connery's character, who just bottom line wants to save his daughter, so that's their motivation covered. So it's a little bit, it's simplistic, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah, but they also, Nicolas Cage's character, he knows the outcome of what these rockets and the chemical weapons will do. Like down to the base of it, his girlfriend's in San Francisco, so he wants to save her. Yeah. But there's also this is my job. This is what I've been trained for. This is. He says it's a gnarly shit. It's something we wish we could disinvent.
Mm.
So he knows the problems of VX gas.
It's nice that they simplify it so much. It's like, it's not just about saving strangers in a city. It's about
to make it a personal.
But then they bring up that point.
It's not even like an immoral. You don't even. Sorry, go on.
Oh no, I was gonna say the great. Almost philosophical and morality discussion with the greater good. There's a scene with the president. He's standing. You know, the hardest decision I have to make. What's 81 souls versus
70,000 or whatever?
A town of 70,000.
Yeah.
And in the middle, there's this general who actually has a valid point of soldiers that were, you know, that have been pissed on and. Whatever.
Yeah, like, yeah. So they need to have their respects given to them. So, yeah. So everyone can get behind. What's his name? It's called
Hummel.
Yes.
Ed Harris.
Ed Harris. All right. Ed Harris. Everyone can get behind Ed Harris's situation.
Hmm.
I don't know why they couldn't just fucking pay. They were like, yeah, fair enough, actually.
Because,
they should have paid their respects and supported their families.
I think part of the reason is.
Oh, my goodness.
Because then we wouldn't have a movie.
No.
Yeah.
Is. Because they are all covert operations. So if paying reparations to these families would admit that they did, it's almost related to debates about saying sorry to indigenous. Because when you admit fault and then there's the issue of reparations. So this is where it's similar in. So if they admit that they sent teams into China into wherever, the Middle East, wherever,
yeah.
then those governments find out, well, oh shit. It's almost the Iran-Contra affair as well, back in the 80s, where the US admitted to supplying arms to Iran to pay the Contras, and that fucked everything
up. So why isn't Ed Harris cancelled in this, in these matters? Because he's just like,
no,
fuck this, they need to get paid anyway.
No, he's trying, he says
his
in the
whole mission
monologue,
is he wants the American government to be held responsible for their actions.
But he does want some of that money to go towards the families of
majority
the
of it. 80,
83 of the 100 million.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it is going to pay for the services of the men that are helping
the mercenaries.
Yeah.
And he says it in the opening line when the movie starts. He says it when he's standing over his wife's grave. I've tried everything that I can humanly do, whether that's going to Congress, through the Pentagon, whatever.
He's going through all the regular channels.
He's gone through all the... This is his last point of that. This is his breaking point that he has to do it.
Which, of desperation.
Yeah. Which, studying terrorism, is exactly how that flow and effect occurs. You start from writing letters, protests, all this, and then you get to a point where you get to a breaking point where there's no point, and at the apex of that point
you become
is the terrorist act.
An evil person.
It's the terrorist act. So it's... So it's like a right angle triangle funneling down
but
into
then
this point.
The one of the shining moments of this film is when Ed Harris realizes that his bluff has been called, and that's it.
Yeah.
I mean that's you can really he becomes
like, get to the chopper's bail, we're done.
Yeah. That point is just amazing because you if you weren't with if you weren't behind him ideologically, and you shouldn't be, but at that point you can get behind him fully. He becomes
he's
like
redeemed.
An anti-hero almost at that point.
Yeah,
he is. He's kind of redeemed.
Yeah,
because he's not really redeemed because he shouldn't have allowed this situation to produce itself.
But he does say, "What have I done?" and tells them where the final rocket is.
Okay,
and he changed the direction of the other rocket that was heading to the
the
football game, and he. Changes
he's a
direction.
Little puppy dog. He's a lovely little man.
He's talked the talk, but he can't walk the walk.
Right. Like, we need blood. We paid for blood.
You would be a great mercenary.
I would.
But those mercenaries are fucking frightening. They are the true grit of villainry in this
they're
film.
Your...
And a who's who of actors from like 90s
they're
movies.
Scary.
The Candyman, guy with the crazy square jaws.
The guy who looks like Viggo Mortensen and Steve Zahn had a baby. John C. McGinley, Buchan Woodbine, so many.
But in the end, they're soldiers and they're just following orders.
Yeah.
So...
No, but they're not because they are acting... It's kind of... like they're not really because...
Well, now we're getting into the whole debate that Michael Biehn tries to put forward in the shower scene.
They've committed treason and mutiny twice over on their original, like they were sworn to.
You signed an oath
to become an American Marine. They are treasonous, and then they're on their own terrorist buddies.
Yeah, but also because he talks about the. The Marines that he's been with, Major Baxter, one of the other token black guys,
the guy from Law and Order,
that they've been together through a number of campaigns. So there is that loyalty that they have to take for this general.
But they he talks to them about it. Sorry, I'm just going to jump in. He talks to them about it when they've arrived. He's like, "You're going to get paid $1 billion, but." You can't come back to America, and they're like, "Oh,
well,
we're here now."
Yeah, we would leave for that.
Shit.
Yeah. What do you do at that point? Except just take the job.
I guess I'm getting paid.
And I also enjoyed the Michael Bay shots that were not like.
It's not as hectic as his later films.
It's still
measured.
Yeah, in a sense, in a Michael Bay sense.
Yeah,
it's still quite hectic.
Yes. In terms of.
And I'm talking. We're talking about like shots per minute kind of thing.
Would you like to know them? I have the details right here.
Do you?
Or I could save that for trivia.
Save it for trivia.
Yeah.
We'll I just. I don't. Part of me thinks. All right. if you took out, like, what would the discussion be if you took out Michael Bay? No, I see what you're going, he has a stigma attached to him
yeah, as a director.
Yes, exactly.
Not at this point, but now we're looking back on it.
But that's why I keep trying to steer it away from saying, you know, discount any everything that happened after this. Let's just focus on this film in and of itself. I think you can see him as a filmmaker. This and Bad, the first Bad Boys film, he's more measured as a filmmaker. He understands shot construction, and he's actually using cinema as a visual language to tell the story, as opposed to what he does in his later films, which is working as a mechanic. He's just piecing things together like a jigsaw puzzle and putting in as much action, as much bang for your buck per shot as you can get.
It sounds like it's the George Lucas situation.
Yeah.
Where George Lucas makes a really good Star Wars film because everybody is allowed to say, George, why don't you do it this way?
Yeah.
I thought about that.
Yes.
And he goes, oh, maybe I should do that. And then you give him the free rein and he just like makes a fucking mess.
This is Michael Bay's second film. It was a budget of, I think, $60 million, I think. It made $300 million worldwide. This is what launched Michael Bay's career, was this film. He got Armageddon off of this. Prior to this was Bad Boys, which I think was 18 mil, like a really low budget in terms of action films. And then he was just music videos. He was still a gamble as a director at this point, and had to bash heads with studios constantly in making this film. And
so he was controlled to a large extent.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Well, shit, man, they need to control him
further
because...
No, they don't, though. His movies make money.
His movies make money.
Oh, God, all right.
I know, but, like, you have to understand, those films aren't for you. Like, and so don't...
But The Rock is for me.
Yes, because...
I'm a man-child.
Yeah.
Where's the man-child, Michael Bay?
It still exists. It does exist in things like The Raid and John Wick.
Turtles,
like,
man.
Yeah, no.
That is a man-child film.
He didn't make Ninja Turtles. Yeah, but then let's look at all the producers that have ever produced a movie and criticize with it.
On that note, can we actually talk about producers and talk about Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer?
Right.
Who produced this? This was Don Simpson's final film as a producer. He died during production. They were the fucking kings of the man-child cinema.
Yes,
like starting with Beverly Hills Cop, Top Gun. Like if you look down their IMDb pages, it's just yep.
That's like an era.
Yes,
an era of film is just a block of just amazing cinema.
They helped create the action modern day action film genre.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's, like, in my opinion, why I think that Criterion have put this one out is because it is the pinnacle. Like, this is the culmination of everything that they'd led up to at this point, and it just kind of is fitting that it was Don Simpson's final one, and then, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer kind of took it a little too far later on, and...
What did he do? What did he do after this?
That's when he started doing things like Con Air and Armageddon, and just, it's...
Few Pirates...
Pirates, yeah, but that's one that Disney...
That's Disney
that was very Disney heavy, though.
And then TV shows.
Yeah, like... Yeah.
The score. I think the score deserves a mention.
Yeah.
It was in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Pirates of the Caribbean came after this, therefore...
But that's what she's saying.
The Hobbit, yeah.
That's what she's saying is, like...
Hans Zimmer is derivative of his own work.
He's copied and pasted.
But yeah, because that's it as well. You can actually see there are elements in the quieter moments of this that's very similar to the Days of Thunder score as well by Hans Zimmer. Like,
and the Pirates of the Caribbean score as well.
Is Hans Zimmer approaching it as like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it?
Yeah, that's a great way to go.
What? That's still fucking lazy.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'm not accusing
you of Hans Zimmer lazy.
No.
You called Hans Zimmer lazy. I don't know.
It's lazy.
I mean,
he probably got paid a fuck ton to do this, like to do the music.
He's just like,
and he's just like, I'm just gonna recycle this shit.
Is Hans Zimmer like, I'll phone it in for the like, you know, The Rock, but like when Gladiator and Pirates come out, that's when I drop my big like.
But musicians in general, like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean. AC/DC have made the same album 14 times. I mean, you can't...
That's for an AC/DC. How do we get here?
here?
Musicians.
Three bottles of wine.
No, it makes sense. It's all right. I'm with you.
John Williams has his constant tropes throughout his scores.
Oh, fucking
I understand, that artists will have a similar sound. Obviously,
yeah.
It's their style.
Yeah.
What we're talking about here, though, is not the same style. It is the same music.
But. But
the Pirates of the Caribbean was done by...
Hans Zimmer.
I think it was...
No, Klaus Badelt.
Yeah.
Klaus Badelt.
But
yeah,
It's not Hans Zimmer.
Intellectual theft.
We need to drop this mic. Well, okay, if the similarities between all of these kind of Hans Zimmer-y type scores, is that then... It's because it's a trope then, right?
You can call it
well,
a trope, yes.
Yeah.
Big bombastic scores.
Yeah.
That's fine, but
this is direct rip-off. This is the same music.
No. You can't say this is direct rip-off because this is 1996. They are ripping off this.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
What?
But the, yeah,
pirates stole it from Rock.
Pirates, yeah, that's
okay.
What you're saying. But then
all I'm hearing is the Rock is better. from his arguments, it's
the
like
main,
it's
the
so
main
good
theme. The main theme that Hans Zimmer produced is very memorable and very, you know, like you can hear that and go like, you know, just like when you hear what's that stupid John Woo film with.
Broken Arrow.
Broken Arrow, thank you.
The Broken Arrow is
Stupid and John Woo don't exist.
No,
in the same
I love
sentence.
That
yes,
movie.
Yes, they do.
So
Paycheck.
Much, it's
Ben Affleck. That movie.
There's heaps of stupid John Woo films, but they're all good.
The Broken. Oh, another great name.
But then my point is that.
That's a great quote, actually. It's the stupid John Woo films, but they're all great.
Yeah, they are. No, my point is that there are certain films, action films that have, like, the John Woo films especially have certain themes which are just like, yes, that is that movie, that is that movie, The Rock
yeah.
has the same thing. So Hans Zimmer did a really good job producing one piece of music that stands out above all the rest of the music in the film.
Yeah.
Can we settle?
Oh, no, I'll say two. There's the big... action score, and then there's the soft choir one that has pan flutes and things.
All the
yeah.
Hobbit stuff,
yeah.
yeah.
Is it because Sean Connery is Scottish, so he put in Irish music because he just didn't know any better?
Yeah, I think so. All
right.
That's
the same country, right?
Yeah.
That's racist.
Well, that's it. Like, you know, you have the guy who's...
You're talking about racist. This film is racist.
And homophobic.
And homophobic.
Yeah.
It doesn't like foreigners.
But, I don't know, we should probably start wrapping up. Is there any other kind of points that we haven't hit on that you guys... desperately.
I don't know. There's nothing else, maybe.
Alright, well,
yeah,
on that note...
So heated.
it's always going to be...
That's what
yeah.
happens when you watch a two-hour film.
Which it never feels like it's two, it's got two
yeah,
hours.
Yeah, actually, we should
it
point that out. Like, Connery and Cage don't arrive at The Rock until the hour 4 minute mark.
Where
it's, yeah, but that's the point. Like, you know, normal films, that is when the third act would be starting. Second act is starting, really, at that point. But you don't feel the length. It's fucking good.
Wonderful.
Yeah. all right, so I'll jump into a little bit of trivia now. So the film was actually nominated for an Academy Award for Best...
Not enough.
It was nominated for Best Sound.
Did it win?
No.
Oh.
There are some crazy sound effects when the camera moves... erratically,
yeah,
like really think like odd noises that makes they make, you know, they're cool noises,
there
but they're just
for the
really loud.
It's genre
yeah.
tropes, it's great, it kind
yeah,
of adds
yeah.
to that tension and that impact. Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer first read the script for The Rock while they were overseeing production on Crimson Tide. Coincidentally, Tony Scott was originally supposed to direct the film, but he turned it down to direct The Fan instead. Yeah, he. Fucked up. The Fan is not good. Alright, so. Take
the
that,
fan
Wes-
is not criterion.
Take that, Wesley Snipes.
That guy is totally forgotten. So.
Well, he's been in jail for a bunch of years. He finally got out
Holy
and
shit,
just acted
what?
In his first new movie.
What did he go to jail for?
Tax evasion. He was in Chi-Raq, Spike Lee's new movie.
And Expendables 3.
Fucking hell.
Jonathan Hensley participated in writing the script, which became a subject of a dispute with the Writers Guild. In this case, the spec script, which was written by David Weisberg and Douglas Cook, was reworked by several writers, but other than the original team, Mark Rossner was the only one who was granted official credit by guild arbitration. The rule is that the credited writing team must contribute 50% of the final script, effectively limiting credits to the initial screenplay writers, plus one rewrite team. Despite their work on the script, neither Hensley nor Aaron Sorkin was credited in the film. Yeah.
There you go.
What?
Yeah, Aaron Sorkin, creator of The West Wing, writer of The Social Network.
Oh, yeah.
A Few Good Men did uncredited rewrites on this. Michael Bay actually wrote an open letter of protest to the Writers Guild in which he criticized the arbitration procedure as a sham and a travesty. He said that Hensley had worked closely with him on the movie and should have received screen credit. Quentin Tarantino was also uncredited rewrites on the scripts.
Why is he involved?
Those one-liners
of his. Tarantino got involved with Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer because he was in a very small little independent film where he had a giant monologue about Top Gun. This is Tarantino as an actor. And they really liked his take on Top Gun about it being like a gay allegory and stuff. And so they brought him in for meetings. This was around the time, like right after Pulp Fiction and things. They hired Tarantino to do rewrites on Crimson Tide. So Crimson Tide has a shitload of Tarantino all over it, and so does The Rock.
Cool.
It's crazy because I want to know what is his.
Yeah.
Like, specifically.
Oh, but that's the thing, like, yeah.
But you can't know, though.
No, and that's the thing, they are, like, because of the Writers Guild, they can't take credit.
Yeah.
Stuff, so,
I know.
Yeah.
That makes it interesting for rewatch, though, to try and spot those.
Yeah, but you're only guessing, like, that's what's...
fun.
It is fun.
It's actually fun to also watch it, knowing that there are so many people putting in their creative input.
I would say
try and pick the different
if
styles.
If I can guess, I'll put a lot of the early Cage moments into a Tarantino-esque vibe.
Yeah, that sort of quirky.
That
kind
of
Beatlemaniac.
The Beatles stuff, like this weird, because that is out of place almost, character. It's not out of place, but it's just an odd quirk that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
I almost
that's
want
to
say the first interaction with Cage and Connery too, the little in the meeting room.
Mm.
See, that seems kind of Aaron Sorkin-y to me a little bit.
Oh, I guess I'm not familiar.
So unfortunate.
you need to watch the shit out of West Wing. Holy crap!
I'm not
going to
do that.
Yeah. Don Simpson was largely responsible for creating the General Hummel character. Simpson watched a 60-minute segment about a US government's refusal to acknowledge soldiers who had died during covert missions overseas, and later read Colonel David H. Hackworth's memoir, which harshly criticized US planning during the Vietnam War.
You know what, man? Surely, if you're a covert agent, you would sign a clause that says you're a covert agent. If you die, the information dies with you.
You saw Bridge of Spies.
Well,
you know how this shit works.
I did
there's
see that.
There's
yeah.
a statute of limitations on that. Like, they can... I think it's after 30 years.
Things can be redacted.
Things can be redacted. And they
get
But then these guys... That 30 years has not passed in this film.
Well, 96...
They're talking about Desert Storm. His main beef is Desert Storm.
Oh.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I think also his beef is not just that they died and it was covered up, but he mentions at one point, Mark is going to correct me here. He mentions at one point the family.
Go on.
The families and the fact that they lied to the families about how and why they died, and basically ruins their memory. Like, it's not that they just said that they covered it up, but it seems like they've been slanderous after they've died and they've received no pension. So
yeah.
their families
they didn't get any
care
of the.
And not only have they been
were.
Lied to about their deaths, but they've been slanderous about them. So it's just like kicking them. You know, like, at the very least they could do is give them the pension and make up a nice lie,
but
they're being cunts about it.
Just, they died saving their country. Just end.
That's it,
That's
yeah.
all you need to
that's
say,
it.
And here's your pension, and yeah.
It's the US government, it's not.
It's not the best government
it's
in the world.
It's not the Kingsmen who
it's
give
the
you
best government in the world,
say.
Is it, guys?
Ooh, controversial!
Well, it's a bit fucked to save a penny at the end of the day. What's the reason for lying, like, being nasty about it? Why can't we all get along? Anyway.
Sean Connery insisted that the producers actually build him a cabin on Alcatraz, as he didn't want to travel to the mainland from the island every day. He got what he asked for. I imagine, though, at night, like, the whole crew leaves, and Connery's just like, ah, the island to myself. There's no electricity. What's he doing?
I know. I'd be more afraid of, like, ghosts and stuff.
Falling down a mine shaft.
We didn't discuss why.
Balrog. Oh, I actually want to see Mike's face when I read this one. Arnold Schwarzenegger was offered the role of Stanley Goodspeed.
Oh.
No way.
Oh, that's it.
He's such a nerd. He would have been brilliant for that role.
He would have.
No,
could you imagine Schwarzenegger and Connery?
No one would have expected that guy to be able to like maintain that action. Like, he's such a geek.
But at the time he was offered the role, the script was only 80 pages long with a lot of handwriting and scribbles, and it didn't seem fully baked. In a Reddit AMA recently, he stated that he regrets not taking the role.
But I don't think you wouldn't have been able to get away with
it. Would have turned Goodspeed into a Mary Sue as opposed to a believable character.
Yeah, and you'd be like, well, why is Connery there? Because there's Schwarzenegger. I mean, the guy has just defeated the Predator. overtook that South American country.
But if that was the character you're going to have, you actually could have written it differently.
Oh, yeah.
Where the character isn't the old wizened man and the geeky...
It's kind of interesting. You kind of harken onto the point of like Connery and Schwarzenegger and things and the character relationship. It was actually reported that Sean Connery accepted the role of Mason after he learned that Nicolas Cage had been cast as Goodspeed. That was what got him on. He wanted to work with Nick Cage.
Awesome.
Yeah. And it was also Nick Cage's idea that his character does not swear in the film.
There was a lot of swearing.
But Nick Cage...
Yeah, he doesn't swear. He says friggin', he says gosh.
Yeah, I noticed that it's because it stood out. It's a little odd.
Yeah, that was the quirk Nick Cage brought to the character. And the final bit of trivia, this was teased earlier. Here is the average shot length for this film. 2.6 seconds. How long things go last?
No, I don't know what that means.
So long.
On average, a shot in this film lasts for 2.6 seconds.
I understand, but like, what does that mean? Is that far?
That's pretty
very
short.
Quick, right?
That's real
quick.
Yeah,
but I don't know. Like, I mean, average.
Yeah, that's
what's the average.
What's the average shot length for Lord of the Rings?
What's the average shot length for Lord of the Rings?
Whatever it is, it's amazing and perfect. And I will hear no thoughts otherwise.
Mike, I want you to know that I actually really enjoyed watching this film.
But she enjoys riling you up more.
It was a lot of fun. I love schlocky action. It is a lot of fun. But The Mines of Moria just threw me. Just threw me. But everything else is fantastic.
Could have been a laundry cart.
Hot Fuzz, man. Hot Fuzz is quicker in terms of average shot length.
Really?
With 1.71 seconds.
That works because Hot Fuzz is a homage to
action films.
Yeah.
It's taking that medium and putting it to its extreme.
And making it comedic. Well,
Moulin Rouge, weirdly enough, is up there.
Oh, that's connected. That's comedic as fuck.
Spaz Lerman.
Yeah.
Spaz Lerman. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Spaz Lerman.
Can I just say, I took a photo of Mike when he had about Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I think he should put it online.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll definitely post that on Twitter for sure. Alright, well, wrapping things up, we'll quickly talk about the actual Criterion Edition itself. It is still available as a 2-disc DVD, but not actually through Criterion anymore. They don't sell it through their label. You can still get the Criterion Edition through Amazon, though, for some reason. They're kind of distancing themselves, I guess. But the the DVD does come with the following special features. An audio commentary by Michael Bay, producer Jerry Bruckheimer, actors Nicolas Cage and Ed Harris, and technical advisor Harry Humphries. Also includes a video interview with Jerry Bruckheimer, analysis of the dive sequence by special effects artist Hoyt Yeatman of DreamQuest Images. That's what it says. Movie Magic episode about the film special effects. Do's and don'ts of Hollywood gunplay with Harry Humphries.
Don't do what Harry does.
Excerpts from Secrets of Alcatraz, a documentary by A La Carte Communications. Storyboards, production designs, trailers, outtakes, and footage of the world premiere actually held on Alcatraz. As well as the usual kind of booklet and essays Criterion usually do.
Fuck this.
Why?
It's just too much at once.
So retarded.
Yep.
You guys are the ones that insisted that I join in here.
No, it's not you. It's just like the idea that you can manage to do a podcast like after 2.5 hours of drinking wine and a blockbuster movie.
I think we did well. So if you have any comments or queries or can solve the mystery of why the minecart chase scene existed and finally settle this ongoing argument between Mike and Cole, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @CriterionQuest And have a look on the Criterion subreddit for Tom's artwork based on this film. But yeah, I guess that will wrap us up for this week's episode, looking at Michael Bay's 1996 film, The Rock. We'll be back next week when we have the 1934 film by Joseph von Sternberg, The Scarlet Empress.
Back to usual.
So I think we might get it.
Back to the usual things.
So I think we might get a nosebleed from the difference in films, but yeah.
Coming down from the altitude.
Yeah. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Mike.
I'm Cole.
I'm Lee.
See you next time.